From the Moan Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, does the departure of people like Les Moonves represent a true Me Too reckoning, or is it just, as one writer calls it, a performance of accountability? Then the directors of the documentary Free Solo, about a climb of El Capitan without ropes, talk about the most revealing scenes in their movie.
The hardest moments to film, they may be difficult while you're doing it, but you know it's only good for the film. And who wants to be filmed in those moments? But those are the moments that make the film real, because it's raw, it's honest.
And a conversation with the subject of the film, professional climber Alex Honnold. All that coming up today on The Frame.
KPCC supporters include Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new film, The Old Man and the Gun, directed by David Lowery and starring Robert Redford in his final on-screen performance, in select theaters Friday.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us as Bill Cosby faces sentencing in a Philadelphia-area courtroom this week for aggravated indecent assault. It would appear that justice is finally being served. His conviction, along with the downfall of other prominent men accused of sexual abuse, like Harvey Weinstein, Les Moonves, and Louis C.K., in some people's minds symbolizes a reckoning. But Megan Garber, a staff writer for The Atlantic covering culture, has written an essay called The Phantom Reckoning about whether or not this is truly the case. When I reached her by Skype, I asked if sentencing Cosby this week is the exception to the rule or if there really has been true accountability.
You can sort of read it both ways. And on the one hand, there have been so many very public downfalls, and that, you know, has, I think, trickle down effects. And I think people are a lot more, cognizant about the problems of sexual harassment, sexual assault and violence, in American culture, but at the same time, I think there's been a lot of, performative reckoning and a lot of performative apologies, I guess. And we haven't really gotten to a place where the apologies feel very real or very sincere.
You have written about Les Moonves, who was shown the door at CBS, but only after another six women came forward with stories of how he allegedly had attacked them. Here's what Stephen Colbert, who worked for Moonves, says about it.
The article is extremely disturbing, and I'm not surprised. That's it. Les Moonves is gone for at least 9 months until he does a set at the Comedy Cellar. We'll see.
I'll explain that reference in a bit, but I want to get back to this idea that you referred to, performative aspect. And you said that what happened at CBS mingles real culpability with a shadow form of it. It combines direct consequences for alleged misbehavior with something more suggestive of accountability theater. What is accountability theater?
I think with Moonves, you see he actually did lose his job. That is a definite thing that has changed. Yet he is, leaving his job with, it's estimated, a $700 million net worth. There is still a chance that he actually leaves with severance from the network. And so, there's this question of, is that a full accountability? I don't know. But on the part of CBS, there was a lot of sort of, dragging their heels about what they should do. And there was a sense of, they put out a lot of press releases, talking about where, we take these allegations very seriously and we are doing an investigation. And they did, bring on lawyers to do an internal investigation, sort of an internal moral and accountability audit, to see whether accusations of a broader culture of misogyny and abuse existed at the network. So that was good. I think on the other side of it, it's very easy to stand behind the claim of we are doing an investigation to excuse not acting in more definitive ways. So I think what we saw with CBS, especially after the first round of reporting about Moonves, was, we're looking into this and sort of a delayed reaction. And then once the second round of reporting came out, it forced their hand.
And it's also not clear if a lot of these people who have been accused of sexual assault and harassment are actually going away. Louis C.K. did a recent set at the Comedy Cellar Comedy Club, got a standing ovation. Matt Lauer and Charlie Rose are reportedly talking about their returns to television. Mario Batali is suggesting that he might be working in a restaurant soon. So what is happening there? Are these people really going away, or are they just going away temporarily?
I think often it's a temporary thing. Definitely that. And I think, you know, to be clear, there's a fairness to that. You know, there we need to be, I think, really, you know, intentional about, you know, the differences of affronts that are in question here. And, you know, these men, you know, are not accused of doing the same thing as, for example, Bill Cosby or, for example, Harvey Weinstein. So, you know, I think it's good to be sensitive to that and to be nuanced in our thinking. But at the same time, it's very revealing to me how much of the cultural conversation really has focused on, you know, what do we owe the men of Me Too versus what do we owe all the people who are not famous, who are not as well known, but who are, you know, just as deserving of moral consideration as these guys. And they just often don't get attention.
Let's say that Cosby is, in fact, sent to jail and he could get a couple of years under the sentencing guidelines. Is that the right or the real end of his story? Is there another lesson to take away from it?
I mean, I think in some ways it is the end just because there's such a finality to actually spending time in prison. You know, that is sort of universally recognized as an admission of culpability, as, you know, the way that we think about justice in this country. You know, but at the same time, it's telling to me that, you know, the judge in this case, in the sentencing case, elected not to have his victims come forward and give testimony about the effects that he had had on their lives. And to me, that's a little bit of a metaphor for how far we have to go in terms of the broader structural problems that we need to think about. Because here you have these women who have had their lives, they say, completely changed, completely upended by Bill Cosby. And he is now facing a reckoning for that. But, you know, what do they get? What kind of closure is this for them?
That's something that the novelist Jennifer Weiner picked up on. And she had a great piece in The New York Times on Sunday. And what she wrote is this, quote, "Stories matter tremendously. They're how we learn about who is real and who is less consequential, whose pain is important and whose not so much, who is the hero and who is merely the hero's reward." So how does the story start changing? How does the culture keep changing?
Oh, I love that quote. And that's such a good question. I mean, I think, you know, we in the media have a really big role to play in it in terms of, you know, deciding which stories to highlight and deciding, you know, which people to pay attention to, you know, and often the people who most deserve a platform are not going to be the famous people, and they're not going to be the wealthy people, and they're not going to be the powerful people. And I think we need to make an effort to tell those stories and to make sure that people who have been marginalized are put at the center of the story. That's going to be crucial.
Megan Garber is a staff writer at The Atlantic who writes about culture. Megan, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Coming up, how the filmmakers of Free Solo weighed the needs of their movie with the ethics of documenting a man risking his life to climb a mountain. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. The new movie, Free Solo, is about as terrifying as any horror movie you've ever seen. And it's a documentary. Free Solo is not only the name of the film, but it's also a form of rock climbing where you don't have a rope or a harness to catch you if you fall. So take that idea and picture a man scaling the face of El Capitan, a sheer granite wall rising 3,000 feet straight up from the floor of Yosemite Valley. One tiny slip, and that's it. Alex Honnold is the only person to scale El Capitan in a Free Solo. Here's Honnold's friend and fellow professional climber Tommy Caldwell, who helped him train for the climb.
I've spent 20 years of my life climbing El Cap, but I never do it without a rope. There's no margin for error. Imagine an Olympic gold medal level athletic achievement that if you don't get that gold medal, you're gonna die. That's pretty much what Free Soloing El Cap is like. You have to do it perfectly.
Filmmakers and husband and wife Chai Vassarelli and Jimmy Chin followed Honnold for 2 years as he prepared to take on El Cap. But when they set out to make the film, they didn't even know that Alex was thinking about Free Soloing it. Here's Chai Vassarelli.
I think for us, we always thought that, I mean, he is a fascinating person. What he does is extraordinary. And it was material enough to make a great character study. At the time, he was single, and so he was living in a van, and he was also dating online a bunch, and we thought that would be kind of humorous, unexpected. But it took this dramatic twist, essentially, when he told us he was considering free soloing El Cap.
So, Jimmy, you have started work on this documentary, and I don't know how far in, but Alex, I guess, break some news to you that he's considering doing this incredible free solo climb of El Capitan. What happens to the film? How far in are you at this point?
We're in like the preliminary development of the film. The idea of soloing El Cap wasn't on the radar for any of us, probably not for really anybody, except for maybe Alex. So when Chai went to kind of meet with him to get a sense of, you know, Alex as a person and a character, and he told her, I was very surprised because I've been working with Alex for 10 years and he's never said it out loud.
The idea of climbing El Cap, obviously I get interview questions about it all the time with like, oh, would you like to do that? And I've always been like, no, well, maybe, we'll see, you know, who knows? But like in the back of your mind, you're like, yes, for sure.
All of his friends, you know, were hopeful that he wasn't thinking about it, but, you know, that's the way we thought about Alex soloing El Cap, is like, I hope he's not thinking about it. So when Chai came back and said, hey, look, Alex told me he wants to solo El Cap for the film, we actually stepped back for a minute because, you know, I told Chai, I was like, I don't know if we're ready to take that on, you know, that sort of a film. And we hit pause for several months to think about it. And I went to a lot of my friends and mentors. Chai and I had a few different conversations. But I think the one that really stuck out to us was the conversation we had with John Krakauer, who said, look, is he going to go and try and solo El Cap even if you don't make a film? And I said, yes. Because when Alex actually voices it, I know his kind of MO. And he said, do you two consider yourselves in a good position to be the best to cover it? And that's a question, you know, you need to answer. And if so, you probably should do it.
So there's a scientific term that I think has an application to this movie. It's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which is essentially that by recording something, you affect it. And it's much more complicated than I'm describing, yeah. But it basically means that you can't record or observe something without changing its course. So how early do you start weighing that your observing of Alex is going to make him do things that may not be in his best interest, but might be good for the film, or maybe not in the best interest of the film, but in his best interest? When does that start becoming a really solid part of the conversation?
Immediately. Because, you know, I've worked on both sides of the lens. I know I'm hypersensitive to what happens when you introduce a camera to any situation, particularly when the stakes are very high. I think Chai has also a lot of experience in that space.
Well, I just think as a documentarian, like especially in the longer formats, like, and you understand fundamentally that how you film, your interaction will definitely affect your subject. And also the film itself has a real impact on their lives. So it was a constant conversation. And, you know, for me as a kind of the third party here, the way Jimmy would kind of weigh these risks and think about how to film it was very, very powerful. And it became like it was about this relationship between the filmmakers and Alex. And I feel like ultimately we all went through this together. And that's why it was important to include it in the movie.
We're talking with Chai Vassarelli and Jimmy Chin. They're the co-directors of the documentary Free Solo. There are two main things that Alex is risking in this film. One is his physical safety, and one is his emotional life, that he's talking to you about how he grew up, how he saw himself as a kid, his relationship to his parents, his love life, all of the things that have made him the person that he is. Was that a conversation that was as difficult as the conversation that you're talking about where is he doing things that are dangerous physically, about what he's going to tell you about the person he is and how much you're going to have to push him to reveal more?
Well, that's what that first conversation between me and Alex was about. Because we really couldn't embark on making this film unless he was open to doing that work. You know, that's the type of film that Jimmy and I are interested in making. It's not, the climbing in this movie is extraordinary, but for us, we really focused on how to tell an emotional narrative that you understood, you know, where he was coming from. You saw him evolve with this relationship and this love, and what were the stakes and how it affected the climbing itself. Like, this was something we were living together. So yes, I think that, we were very clear being like, Alex, there's a lot of work to be done. Is that okay? Are you ready? I don't think anyone understands the work until you're in it.
Jimmy, there's a point in the film where Alex hits the pause button himself and is not ready to do something that you guys want to record. And while it's probably good for Alex, it's probably not great for your film. It's like, we're ready to go. Let's do it. How do you react when you have to pause because of what your subject wants to do and what he doesn't want to do?
Well, this is the thing. When you go and do a documentary film like this, you have to have a mindset that things are going to go in possibly a lot of directions. And in other words, you have to anticipate what might or might not happen, best case scenarios, worst case scenarios, kind of all the different types of scenarios, and be open and flexible in what happens. And then also, as a good filmmaker, you should be able to leverage whatever happens in the service of the film, which, you know, I think in the end, it did service the film.
I think as a filmmaker, those are the moments, like the hardest moments to film. They may be difficult while you're doing it, but you know it's only good for the film. And I mean, that moment that you're referring to was horrible to film.
Horrible.
But
because your movie basically has stopped.
Well, I think ultimately it was very good for the movie. It makes the movie stronger, and also it was great for our team because we had practice. But, you know, just emotionally, like it was a real, I felt for him, like we were there living something with him, and it was difficult. And who wants to be filmed in those moments? But those are the moments that make the film real, because it's raw, it's honest.
You have cast kind of as your central character, Alex, who is doing this climb, but you also cast camera operators, and they're climbers, and they have to be in very dangerous situations themselves. So when you're putting together your crew about the people who are going to photograph Alex's climb, what are you looking for, and what does the resume look like of somebody who's going to perch on some precarious pitch of El Capitan with a camera and try to record this climb?
So we had two teams. You know, I kind of ran most of the high angle team, and then Chai was really focused on the verite.
So high angle team is people on the rock,
yes,
looking down.
So the high angle team, you know, my high angle DP, Mikey Schaefer, he's a full professional climber, you know, pays a lot of attention to detail, knows me very well, knows Alex very well. You know, almost everybody on the team was a professional climber. Their skill level and technical capacity had to be at the very top end, because Alex is also the fastest big wall climber in the world, arguably. And so there are a lot of logistical issues that are tied into trying to film somebody on a huge wall that's moving that fast. You have to have the best camera team you possibly can. These guys are top-notch climbers in their own right, but they also have a great eye, and they also have to be able to function at a very high level when the stakes are high.
There is a photographer on the floor shooting up as Alex is doing the climb, and he cannot watch. He is so scared of what he's witnessing. It looks like he should be operating a camera, and he just can't even look through his own eye finder.
Well, that's Mikey. And I honestly, when we were cutting that together, I was like, am I ruining Mikey's career? No. I mean, that's just who he is. I mean, I think the main question you were also asking of these excellent climbers and cinematographers was, could they live with the risk? Like, are they on board to be part of our team? But there was a very kind of sweet cross, it's kind of like an exchange student situation where, you know, the team that was the Verite team and our producers were all, and myself, all came from kind of, you know, deep, long format feature documentary backgrounds. And I just remember, like, Shane, this one high angle DP, coming up to me being like, I looked up cinema verite on Wikipedia. And so we would just talk about the types of shots we were interested in. And it was just a real exchange of talents. And also for the, you know, the feature doc side, just understanding what were the parameters we were dealing with.
Jimmy and Chai, great to see you.
Great to see you, John.
Thanks, John.
Coming up on The Frame, we hear from Alex Honnold himself, the subject of Free Solo, about why he agreed to let a film crew shoot this life or death climb.
KPCC supporters include Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting the new film, The Old Man and the Gun. Robert Redford stars in his final on-screen performance with Casey Affleck, Danny Glover, Tom Waits, and Sissy Spacek in select theaters Friday.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. So it's not often that an entire interview is a bit of a spoiler in and of itself, but here we go. If you're considering watching the new documentary Free Solo and wonder if professional rock climber Alex Honnold survives, well, we just talked with him at the Telluride Film Festival, and yes, he was very much alive. The documentary Free Solo centers on Honnold's free solo climb of the face of El Capitan in Yosemite National Park last year. He's the first and only person to ever do it. When I talked with Honnold, I asked him to explain what makes climbing El Cap so difficult.
I think the easiest way to describe El Cap is just for somebody to have seen it or to look at it. I mean, because it's just such a immense wall, and it's this big vertical sheer granite face. It's 3,000 feet tall. It's just an awe-inspiring piece of rock. I mean, you know, like in the same way that a cathedral or something is awe-inspiring, you walk in it, so there's a certain grandeur to it. But I mean, it's difficult just because it's 3,000 feet tall and it's very smooth.
And there are people who have climbed it, but obviously they've climbed it with ropes. So they have scouted, you know, which way to go around which pitch, but they don't have the risk of getting it wrong and that being the end of
Typically you have a rope and gear, and so it's totally safe if you fall off. It's totally normal to use the rope for assistance. But actually, I think one of the good ways to put it in perspective is that most people that climb El Cap spend 3 to 5 days camping on the wall to get up it. And so the mental shift between spending 5 days camping on the wall versus climbing it by yourself with no equipment in a couple hours, it's a big gap, you know? And so it took me a long time to sort of reconcile that, like to believe that it was possible to leave all your camping gear behind and just go up there.
When you think back about climbing as a kid and climbing as an adult, are you able to remember the feeling that climbing as a kid gave you, and does it feel the same?
I mean, I was just kind of described as joyous. The movement, if you imagine a monkey swinging through a tree, or you know, a kid frolicking on a playground, it's the same feeling, but for an adult. I think, it's joyous. Like I love the movement, the feeling of climbing.
At what point did you decide that free soloing, climbing by yourself without ropes, is something that had a special appeal to you?
So growing up in California, there's a whole history and culture of free soloing. And so as a kid climbing in the gym, I was definitely reading about and hearing about, you know, basically like legendary climbers before me that had done a lot of free soloing. And so as I grew up, it was just something that I felt like I should maybe try to do. And then when I started to do it a little bit, I enjoyed it and I found it very significant. You know, I found that it gave me a lot. But I think it's important to explain that, you know, it's not as if I free solo all the time. Like it's a very small percentage of my overall climbing. And even though the film Free Solo is all about free soloing, the majority of my time is spent just climbing normally with my friends, with ropes, with partners. And then the occasional experience I do by myself because it's, you know, more of an experience.
So a couple years ago, two things happened around the same time. Jimmy and Chai decide that they want to make a documentary about your climbing, and you decide that there's a climb that you want to do. How did one beget the other?
Yeah, so I don't know. I mean, those are kind of separate things in a way. So, I mean, they decided to make the film, or they wanted to make the film. And the thing is, I'd been dreaming about soloing El Cap for maybe 8 years at that point. And each season I would show up in Yosemite and think like, this is the year that I'm going to solo El Cap. And then I'd drive in, look at the wall and be like, oh my God, this is not the season I'm going to solo El Cap. And so, you know, I'd wanted to for quite a long time. So it's not as if I just decided all of a sudden, but then they approached me about doing a film, and I sort of saw the film as a good opportunity to finally actually put the effort in and try to solo El Cap. Because, so the thing was, I sort of realized that without putting in all the work and putting in the effort, I would never really know if I was able to solo El Cap. I realized that it was never just going to happen, you know?
Yeah.
Like a lot of my solos, I just sort of get fit, I get ready, and then at some point I feel it and I just do it, and it doesn't require that much work. But I realized that with El Cap, I was going to have to put in a ton of work. And so it made a lot of sense if they wanted to shoot a film for me to tie it to El Cap. You know, it gave me a reason to start putting in the work to like do what I had always wanted to do.
But it also becomes an issue because the reason to do the work makes you maybe in the back of your mind do something for them as opposed to for yourself. So how do you negotiate that in your own mind, what's good for the film versus what's good for me, basically just in terms of safety and preparedness?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm obviously always thinking a little bit about what's good for the film, but ultimately I care about myself a lot more than I care about the film. And so, you know, I care about my own safety. I care about my own survival infinitely more than I care about getting a shot for a movie. And so, you know, yeah, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking about the filming process, but really I'm just doing my own thing. Because to me, the most important thing was always to climb the wall.
Your fellow climber, Tommy Caldwell, talks about this idea of mental armor and the armor that is necessary to climb. And there's certain things that can break that armor, romantic relationships, being filmed. Are you aware of that kind of assets happening about how that armor is constructed and what might threaten it?
So it's interesting. I actually have a quote talking about mental armor in one of my original films about free soloing from 2009, I think, Alone on the Wall. And I talk about how I had mental armor on Half Dome and ran out and I got very scared and et cetera. And my whole process has changed quite a bit and my approach to free soloing has changed. And so I don't really see it in those terms anymore. Like, I don't think about mental armor. I don't think about having my armor on. I think of it now more in terms of broadening your comfort zone and slowly desensitizing yourself to certain things until they feel comfortable. I think mental armor is closer to, like, if you've heard the term Kodak courage, you know, where someone holds a camera and you're suddenly like, okay, I'm just going to go for it. It's kind of the same idea. Or if you, like, listen to really loud rock music and you're like, yeah, I'm doing it, like getting psyched up and then doing something. I think mental armor is sort of that same idea where you, like, build it up, like, okay, I'm doing it. And then you hope that you finish the task before your armor runs out or you get scared or something. And I realized on Half Dome when I ran out of mental armor that that's not really a sustainable approach to taking on those kinds of challenges. You know, because if you run out, like if you get unpsyched partway through, then all of a sudden you're sort of helpless on this wall and it's very, very scary. So the better way is to not build up an armor or whatever, but to actually just feel, you know, to know that even with no armor, even naked, I can walk up to the wall and feel comfortable and, you know, I'm ready for this all the way through.
Alex, great to see you.
Oh, thanks. Thanks a bunch for having me.
Free Solo is in theater starting this Friday. And that's our show for today. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back here tomorrow.